the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? How you doing? Are you holding up in the heat? Where are you? It's fucking over, man. We are watching the planet die. It's dying, and I guess some of you have better seats than others currently, but we will all be, the bleacher seats are going to be fine come the next few years. Doesn't matter where you're sitting, you're going to see the show. You know what I'm saying? But I hope you're holding up. I hope you're making do. I hope you're keeping cool. I hope you're not stroking out. Take it easy, man. Slow it down. Get into a child's mind and a lizard heart. Just, you know, kind of get in the shade and turn it down. Slow down that metabolism. Take it in. It's dark, but it's light. You know what I'm saying? It's hot, but it's cold reality. Today on the show, I talked to Steven Soderbergh, the director, going all the way back to Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Oceans 11, 12, and 13, Traffic, Contagion. The list goes on. I'm a huge fan of Traffic, but I'm a bigger fan of Behind the Candelabra, the Liberace movie he did, I think, for HBO. Oh, my God. Fucking Michael Douglas just gives into it, man. Who are you talking to, Mumbles? I love that movie. I love it. It's interesting about him because in comparison to Tarantino, who draws from every type of movie ever and just kind of mashes it up, mashes it together in his sort of montage collage of a thousand styles and shots and homages. And Soderbergh actually is quite different. He actually locks into a style or tone for an entire film and he holds it, but he doesn't stay the same. I mean, he's always challenging himself, I think, with technology and also with just tone and style. And I watched the new film, No Sudden Move, which is a straight-up noir with Don Cheadle and Benicio del Toro. And it's a multi-layered, fairly complex noir. And it's tonally tight, very specific, and different than his other movies. He definitely takes chances, and he is a masterful director, and I'm glad we got to talk. We did do it over Zoom, because that was the way it was set up initially. So that is that's going to happen. It was exciting to talk to him. I was a little intimidated. I was more intimidated by Soderbergh than I was Tarantino, because Soderbergh seems like a kind of a serious guy, straight shooter, just a little, heady dude. But it worked out fine. I want to give a little love, send a little juice to this thing that's going on in... it's a tribute. Now, I don't know how many of you know Barry Crimmins. He's a great comic. We had him on the show a couple of times, and he used to work with me and Brendan over at Air America. It was actually his interview on this show that inspired Bobcat Goldthwait to do the documentary about Barry, Mr. Lucky. But he was also the founder of the influential Boston area comedy club, The Ding Ho, which you might have heard me talk about with lots of comics, especially the Boston guys. Well, Jimmy Tingle is one of those guys, and Jimmy helped organize a 40th anniversary celebration of The Ding Ho that you can watch this weekend as part of a fundraiser. Jimmy is joined by Stephen Wright, Paula Poundstone, Bobcat Goldthwait, Dennis Leary, Lenny Clark, Don Gavin, Jack Gallagher, Tony V, Kenny Rogerson, and just a ton more comics, so many more comics, to laugh and celebrate both Barry and the Ding Ho. You can watch it by making a donation to support Barry's wife, Helen. When Barry died in 2018, his wife, Helen, was in the middle of her fight with stage 4 non-Hodgkin lymphoma. The fundraiser helps with her medical and living expenses. The tribute is airing July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. That's tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday. Go to jimmytingle.com for tickets. The Ding Ho. The Ding Ho. I remember going there when I was in college, when I first started doing comedy back in the mid-80s. My first solo, it was probably the last summer the Ding Ho was open, but I was able to get on that stage. It was back when Tingle, a lot of harmonica in Tingle's act. I remember Ron Lynch was in a team called Bob and Ron. Lenny Clark used to host the open mic where he would do 45 minutes between acts. Mark Clark was a door guy. And it was connected to the Chinese restaurant, which I never ate at. The only thing I remember about performing at the Ding Ho was one time I was about to go on and I spilled a drink on my pants. It looked like I pissed myself and I had to go on like that. I had to work with it. I don't remember having a good set. I can remember what the inside of the club looked like. I can remember what it felt like to be on stage there. But I don't remember anything about performing there. But I remember it. I remember being there. And I remember sitting at the bar with Ron Lynch and his partner Bob after I came out of the bathroom or after I had just spilled a drink on myself. And I went to the bathroom to try to dry it and to no avail. And I was just starting out. And it was another traumatic experience. I've really been thinking about this lately. A lot. Just the PTSD necessary to sort of continue pursuing comedy. Like, I was thinking back at some of the gigs that we were doing. Like, because people, when the store reopened, the Comedy Store, people were like, there's nobody here. I'm like, so what? Don't you remember doing this? I mean, when people say at the beginning, now it's packed. But the first couple of weeks, it was small audiences. They were distanced. They couldn't only let a certain amount of people in. And people were complaining. I'm like, are you fucking out of your mind? Just get your work done, for fuck's sake. I mean, do people forget? I've done shows for 2 people, 4 people, 8 people, 9 people, 12 people, 15 people spread out. I've driven 200 miles to perform for 7 people. I've done in shows in bars and discos and bowling alleys and fucking veterans halls. I've done shows. I mean, I don't even know how I did it. I was an angry, neurotic, furious Jewish kid in my early 20s, just roaming all over the New England countryside to walk into situations I had fucking no idea what I was getting into, to go up cold and do a half hour before 45 minutes. I don't know how I did it. Just thinking about it now makes me embarrassed and uncomfortable and fucking sad as fuck for that guy. And, you know, I don't know who that kid was, but I do know that I locked in somehow. I kept going. I had shattered my sense of rejection to the point where somehow or another I managed it, but there, I still feel it. The sensitivity, the terror. Not when I do a theater and not even when I go on to store or whatever, but like somebody asked me, I think Lance over at Permanent Records, he's like, do you want to do a show at the record store? And the thought of walking into a record store and doing, you know, just a gig on a small stage or whatever, just a gig in a room that's not a stand-up room or a theater, not a like legit place. I'm like, I can't handle it, man. I don't want the stress of that. I like the parameters defined. You know, I can't do it. After years of performing in every shithole that you can imagine, of all kinds, you know, even if they're bars, doesn't mean they're built for performances. Hotel ballrooms. I'm just like, I'm not, it was like the same thing with performing at these outdoor shows or drive-in shows during the pandemic. I don't want the stress of that. Give me a comedy club, give me a small theater, a big theater, I don't care. But the anxiety of just going up, either cold or even with an opener in a situation that is makeshift, I can't. It's like a trigger, man. And I don't know if I would frame it as PTSD because, I intentionally put myself into all those situations, but for years, going back to the Comedy Store was like visiting the abuser. And when I really think about some of those gigs, it's just horrendous to me. I did it. I learned my fucking craft. I know how to get in shape now. But just terror. And just even the thought of it now, like I'm going on tonight, you know, at Dynasty Typewriter with a bunch of half, you know, half ideas, a few jokes, a few things. And I'm going to riff it out. And that's how I do it. And like, my brain is on fire. I'm on edge. I'm furious at everything. I'm furious at myself. And this happens innately. I don't know why this is the way that my brain needs to generate, why this is the method. But like, I just, like, I know, like, today, heading into this thing, my brain will just fucking rip open, and I'll start putting things together, and I'll outline and stuff, and I'll just go kick it around up there in front of people. It's terrifying. There's nothing not horrendously stressful about it. But it's always the way I've done it, and this is how I'm going to do it. I'm not happy about it. I don't know what's going to happen. I never give myself the benefit of the doubt, given that I've done this for half my fucking life at this point. I'm just on, I am at the edge, man. And I know on some level it's like, hey, man, it's not sober behavior. You know, maybe you need a meeting. You're dry. You're this or that. This is the way it goes. And I never remember that this is the way it goes. I want to quit. I don't want to do it this way anymore. I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to. And I'm just, I get myself into this fucking meltdown mode. I guess it's my innate way of building up the courage to fucking do this show, because it's all life or death for me. I'm not going up there with a list and like, well, that joke didn't work. I got to put it on the line. I guess that's what I live for. What makes it all worthwhile is for me to get up there not knowing what's going to happen, to put myself in this situation where I have to be funny and not exactly sure where it's going to come from, and wait for it to come and hope it does come. Then all of a sudden it's delivered to you. You don't know where from. You're just like, you're sort of like, you're kind of fishing the air. I'm going to go fishing in the ether to see if I can catch some tags, some jokes, some brilliance, just a moment. Will it come? Will it come? And when it comes out of nowhere, it's sort of like, there it is. It's been delivered. That moment. It's fucking horrible to have to depend on that. Wouldn't it be easier just to write a fucking joke, Marin? Wouldn't that be it? Who are you calling Marin? I'm you, dude. You. All right. Relax, man. Steven Soderbergh's new film is called No Sudden Move. It's a movie. And you'll hear. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to miscall it a film. You'll understand what I'm saying after you listen to me and Steve. His new movie, No Sudden Move, is now streaming on HBO Max. And this is me talking to Mr. Soderbergh. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. I tell you, man, this thing has got me, like, all those people in that one room, it is causing me more stress than having to be in person with that many people. Soon, Stephen, there will be, are you going to make a movie all on Zoom? Is that something you can do?
Oh, God. Would anybody want to see that?
I don't know. We seem to be used to it. I mean,
I know, but it's gotten me anxious, like in.
Right.
I don't know. I get like anxious on them because it feels very performative.
Yes.
And when I feel like I'm expected to like deliver, I get really anxious. It's like a new thing. I mean, were you as a performer?
Yeah.
Were you ever nervous?
Sure. I was, you know, 5 minutes ago, I was filled with dread and anxiety. And it wasn't until I saw your face and I was like, oh, there he is. It'll be fine. Yeah, I get dread all the time. Not so much doing stand up anymore. I don't know when that went away, but it was about 30 years into my career. I spent a long time pretending not to be afraid. And then eventually one day you're like, oh, I know how to do this.
Right.
So you don't generally have anxiety when you have to approach a film?
No. That kind of stuff doesn't make me nervous at all. Professional stuff to me is not worth like getting really emotional about. Personal stuff I get very anxious about. And that's what I mean. Something is like leaked over. You know what I mean? Yeah. Something what used to be strictly professional, now it feels like it's leaking into something personal. It's making me really anxious.
Well, are you saying that in this age of social media platforms and easy access to almost anybody, that your boundaries are being a little a little strained?
Yeah, it's
terrible.
It's one of the worst experiments ever.
You mean the general experiment of capitalism's exploration of social media and mining our brains entirely?
Well, just as another chapter in the, you know, how did we get here book.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and also the continual experience of counterintuition.
Right.
Of watching people, you'd think, oh, I absolutely know what's going to happen here. And that is absolutely not what happens. That, like, it's not how people react.
Right. Right.
Or respond. Like, it's disorienting.
Like what's an example of that?
Well, I think it's when you try to, let's say, either incentivize or disincentivize people to do one thing or another.
Right.
And so, how many times does it happen that the plan is announced? If you do X, we will give you Y.
Right.
It goes horribly wrong. Either too many people show up and the thing just crashes.
Yeah.
Or nobody shows up and it's a complete waste of time.
Right.
But in both instances, we feel, and it's hypocritical, but we feel our first reaction is, how did you not see that coming?
Right.
So it's just so crazy.
It's a 50-50 proposition, though.
Yeah. I mean,
you can see both things coming and you're hoping that it's going to be more than one person. The real sad thing is when you get there and there's no one there, but two people, you kind of feel like, well, I mean, there's two. So
Yeah.
We got to put on a show, I guess.
Well, like you said, it's 50-50, and that implies a certain reality of or acknowledgement of uncertainty.
Uh-huh.
That is unsettling.
Sure. And I guess
it's real and it's true, but it's unsettling.
Right. Well, I mean, there's very few things we have control over. I imagine a movie's one of them. That's probably about 95% or right.
Well, it's certainly in terms of the, you know, when you're working on the thing, the amount of control that you're able to exert on that thing isn't, you know, normal.
Like
most people don't go to work and have that kind of power.
Of course.
But at the same time, in my experience, you're mistaken if you feel you really control it.
Oh, right.
There are too many human beings involved.
Yeah. That's the worst.
There just are.
It's just too many people. I see? I saw your, I don't know how close you are with Tom Papa, but I see him a lot doing comedy. I saw him the other night.
Tom's a good friend. He's funny.
Yeah. He's like, I said to who I was just sitting in the back of the room. I was going on after him. I said, you know, watching him is like watching something that has always existed in comedy. He's got some sort of timing that seems sort of like ever present, you know, throughout the entire undertaking since stand up, you know?
Yeah. It's you're right. It's a sound. It's a verbal equivalent of a kind of music.
Yes. Right. Yeah. There's a rhythm.
A rhythm.
Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yep.
Goes all the way back. Goes all the way back to the Borscht Belt.
So you basically just called him the oldest comic ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Him and Jeff Ross. I'll do it right to their face. they're part of the continuity for sure. So I watched a new movie and I was thinking about, because it took me, it's like a multi-tiered noir, I guess, is really yeah. what it is, and it really sort of seeks to address almost all the buttons of noir in a way, doesn't it?
Absolutely, I hope so.
Yeah, and then I started thinking about the movie that you based on, The Underneath. I just saw Robert Siodmak movie recently, a couple of them. And there's something profound and simple about the way that guy made movies. Was he some sort of influence on you when approaching this type of material?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that, like you said, there's a clarity to it that I think is deceptively simple.
In Robert's movies?
Yeah. But also in the best examples of this genre, right. Like when it's done really well,
yeah,
they achieve a sort of clarity that requires, in my experience, a lot of very specific effort.
Yeah,
and so I think sometimes that gets lost.
Interesting. Yeah. Know? Right.
But there's just for this, I wanted to sort of be in the room with a certain kind of film from that period, but I didn't want it to be a purely representational recreation of that era.
Well, I definitely felt that. I mean, it definitely has a very controlled and consistent look to it in terms of the tone of the color. Right. And also in the way it seems like you structured almost all the shots. I couldn't tell whether it was my screener or was it intentional.
No, those are very wide lenses.
OK, so that was there for a reason.
That was totally on purpose.
And what effect do you get from that? What does it do psychologically? What do I need to know?
Oh, well, I would never venture a guess as to what its effect might be, but its intention, I think, was to sort of in a too literal way, bring you out of a space in which you have a 90 degree grid, essentially,
right?
Yeah, a world in which things are that squared off,
right?
Like, I mean, that I know that sounds incredibly pretentious, but that really felt wrong to me to have images that were that sort of square,
right? Okay.
So I purposefully went and found this set of lenses that embraces the inherent anomalies of any anamorphic lens.
Okay,
like. They are just like, we're going with it.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's bendy.
Yeah.
Like we're going to do it. And I thought this is perfect for us.
That's sort of interesting. Cause I'm sitting there going like, oh, this must be the screener, I guess. But it was completely intentional. Now I have
what time of day was this?
It was during the day, but now I got to go back and watch it. And it's like, no, this is on purpose. This is like, no, but, are you just discontent with anything that is sort of the old reliable way of moving forward?
No, not at all. It's more. Is there a way to blend different things that have worked before into something that doesn't feel exactly like either of them?
Yeah. And the story, the execution of the story and how it continues to unfold and how you have, you've got a mob movie, you've got a revenge movie, you've got a guy seeking some sort of personal justice. You've got several different factions of the mob. Then you've got one of the biggest American industrial complexes, involved in this document. When you approach that material, do you realize, like, I guess the real challenge outside of finding these new lenses is, how do you flatten this story enough for it to all sink in?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the running conversation, and it doesn't really conclude until you've locked and delivered the movie. what information should be released at what point and by whom.
Right, right.
Like that's literally, it's really, really comes down to that, because how you end up doing that directly affects the audience's ability to engage and sort of give you a little bit of runway. Like you want them chasing you a little bit, but they need to feel intention.
Right.
And they need to feel like their interest will be rewarded.
Yeah.
And so if you confuse them or somehow allow them to disconnect, you know, it just gets harder to pick them back up. So this was a movie where we are constantly analyzing what character knows what, when, and should this scene come here, or should, like, we really wanted the math to be clean.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it definitely was, because even if like you're like not unlike Chinatown or some of the more complicated noir movies, you know, even if you think you missed something, by the time all the stories pay off, you're like, oh, what? Oh, no. You know, so there's that triple, like, what the fuck? Oh, really? And then at the end, you're sort of like, all right, that was good.
Well, good. Because look, we were in one regard, we weren't following the map of the typical noir, because the movie does not end with a gun battle.
Right, right. And it doesn't, you know, end with the with the woman dying or getting away with something, right?
No. No, not in the version I did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of interesting in this movie, though, you know, given, like, I talked to Sharon Stone about Mosaic, you know, and I was able to watch that. You know, unfortunately, I just watched the movie version. I didn't, you know, setting up for it. But it seems like in this outing, the only thing you really did that was, kind of pushing the envelope was using that lens. So it bent at the sides, which also I think creates, now that I think back on it and, you know, what you're saying about the 90 degree thing, but it also is a reminder of that you're watching a movie in some degrees, which is, you know,
yes.
Kind of the old French New Wave trick, you know, hey, surprise, it's an illusion. But
yeah, well, I did think of it in my mind as a movie as opposed to a film. I think that those are slightly different things. And so for me, the more movie-ish it was, the better.
Oh, interesting. So what you want to tell me what the difference is so I make sure I know?
One of them wins awards.
Can you tell me which one?
Oh, I think it's fairly obvious that if you were doing like you know, the equivalent of a flashcard test,
yeah,
where you held up the poster for a piece of cinema,
yeah,
and asked a person, like, do you consider that a film or a movie, and just took that data,
yeah,
that the ones that they identified as films would in the aggregate have more awards.
Huh.
And, I think.
And you didn't make one of those. You made a movie?
This is a movie.
Okay.
This is a movie.
So you basically, are we putting it out in the world that you're not, you don't want to win awards? You're not expecting awards?
It's in terms of its intention.
Okay. So what is that? To entertain?
To just entertain. Yes.
And when you do something like Mosaic, which was involved an app and involved sort of an ability to sort of investigate the movie's plot through other means and go deeper than you would normally, that is also, I assume, a more complicated entertainment. Yes.
Yeah, we didn't know what to call it.
Yeah.
Like that was a challenge.
So what do you think was then, from your point of view, the last movie you made, or the last film?
Last film. Che.
Oh, really?
Yep.
And so does that come down to a business decision for you?
No.
It just is. You look at the material and you take the gig.
Yeah, it's hell yeah. There are two categories: hell yeah and no.
Right. Okay. And so hell yeah can be anything that you're interested
in. Absolutely.
Because I have to be honest, behind the candelabra, I've watched like four times.
Oh my God.
And I, you know, primarily for the line where Michael Douglas goes, "Who are you talking to, Mumbles?" Just, oh, yeah. That, I mean, you must have been on the set of that, it, watching Michael Douglas do that. You must have just been entertained every fucking day.
They really just, you know, ran toward it. They just really, it was really fun to watch Michael and Matt just do it. Like, just do it.
Yeah.
And it was a really, for me, a really special kind of experience, because in theory, that was going to be my last thing.
And but yeah, I know that I've heard that you point, because I do that too. Like, over the pandemic, I realized, like, not only do I not miss stand up, but maybe I'm all better. Like, it becomes like sort of like, why was I doing this to begin with? How come I feel relief? Maybe I'm done. Yeah. So what drove you to decide that you might be done?
Oh, I think just the business was making me a bit nutty. I didn't understand the process by which large scale important decisions about, you know, where everything should go,
yeah,
were being made, because they seemed so so much in opposition to my experience of how to solve creative problems, like how to answer a question. I was absolutely aware that there was, and there is, a certain amount of information that I don't have access to about why they make the decisions they make.
Right.
You know, I'm even though I'm working for them, I don't know what assumptions they make about growth, eyeball migration, subscription costs. Like, I don't know.
Isn't a lot of times the decisions they make based on their own fear of failure?
Well, if that's true, that's not a knock, because that's most of us.
Yeah.
So I just wish that at that point in 2013, my unwillingness to acknowledge that,
yeah,
you know, was just making me really frustrated. I think afterward I realized I let it bleed. I thought it was about my job, and it wasn't about my job.
Yeah.
Because once I started doing my job again, I was really happy.
Yeah.
And so I realized that I'd allowed, you know, my sort of bafflement to really take me off course and slow me down. I shouldn't be like giving that so much real estate, like just go to work.
Right. To judge yourself against this sort of like nebulous disappointment with the intentions of the industry.
Yeah. You know, like, yeah, it was like a weird.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was in some free floating like funeral or something. I don't know. Anyway, it stupidly, I had let it kind of,
right,
you know, bleed into my day job.
Yeah.
And once I got past that, everything got better.
But you did stop for a while, right?
It was very, very brief. It was embarrassingly brief.
And what was the plan? You're like, I'm going to do this now.
I was going to take painting lessons.
Did you?
Yes.
And how do you find, are you still painting?
No. Nope, I never did.
You never.
No, I mean, I got two lessons in, and then I got the script for The Nick.
And that re-engaged you. People love that series. And that was just,
I love doing it.
Yeah. And that's like steady work. That's not like I'm going to make a movie. It's like, we got a whole thing to do here that's going to go over, you know, many episodes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, so much fun. It was so much fun.
Now, when you talk about it, it's like when you talk about the job, you know, because like you're a guy who, like, there are certain movies that you've made that, you know, made an indelible impression on me. I mean, all the way from the beginning, because I went to college with Steve Brill. So when you cast him.
Oh, shit. Really?
Yeah. We used to do comedy together.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But I remember that movie as being like some sort of globally, you know, it was a game changer on so many levels. Right.
Let's not debate that.
Yeah.
It was an unexpected thing.
Right. So then that sets you going. And then over the course of the scene, like, where did you, you know, did you study film?
Yeah, but not formally.
Not formally. So you made
I didn't go to school for it.
So this is like, so you're kind of an autodidact in this medium.
By law, I am described as self-taught.
Yeah. Really? By law?
If in a legal case, I think they would have to say that.
So the evolution of this skill set, that's interesting to me, because anytime you change the approach that you take, because this movie is really the movie you just made is unlike any other movie you made to some degree, because
I hope so.
Right. Yep. Because you're constantly employing, you know, everything that you've learned, everything that you're a fan of, and everything that you want to try in each movie. But you do have certain consistencies around, like, you know, tone. I guess what I'm trying to get at is you keep talking about the job. So do you not see yourself as an artist? Do you see that the director's is primarily an occupation that you apply to in any way that the material demands? Do you not think that a point of view or some sort of auteur authorship is necessary?
Well, I'm an absolute believer in the idea of a decider.
Right. You know,
there needs to be a decider.
Right.
And I think the best results have been when that decider is very, very specific and rigorous about all of the choices that have to be made to get something done. You know, I tell people, it's like, if you don't like answering questions, do not take this job.
Yeah. Answering questions.
That's all it is.
But you're answering them, you know, in the face of the task. It's not people are asking you questions, are they?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Like actors, like producers, like,
yeah, oh, you know, yeah.
Lighting people, like where? Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, which lens? What do we, yeah, so okay.
Everything. Everything all the time. That's the job. And the more unified the answers are, I think the better the piece.
But do you think that ever think that because of your natural compulsion to do new things and change things up all the time has in some way denied you a specific voice? Like, do you feel that people can see a Soderbergh movie and go like, this is a Soderbergh movie?
Or didn't? Oh, I don't think. I don't, that, to me, that ends up, if that becomes true, that becomes a potentially dangerous thing, because I think being a brand in any sense of that word in terms of, is like a terrible idea.
Because you'll be expected to deliver on that brand.
Yeah, because then, yeah, exactly. Then it's, and, you know, what keeps me, you know, activated is the possibility of something in front of me that I'm going to learn something new,
right,
and get challenged in some way that's going to be new, or it has demands that I've never had to meet before. Like, that by definition, I want it to keep changing.
Well, there was a point early on, I think, right, where, you know, you were pushing the envelope for yourself, and, you know, and I think, you know, some movies were not received as, you know, in any real way. But I mean, but do you see those in retrospect as necessary learning experiences?
Oh, absolutely. In every particular, it's not fun to lose people money. I don't enjoy losing money for people. But, you know, the point is, you have to, if at any stage, I mean, unless you're talking about catastrophic failure after catastrophic failure, you can't second guess yourself.
Yeah.
You can only make something that you want to see, that you would stand in line to go see.
Yeah.
And if you're, if you're getting into some sort of predictive state, I just think now you don't know where north is. And so luckily, occasionally, like these concentric circles, you know, I'll make something that people seem to want to get eyeballs on at that particular moment. Then there could be a fallow period. Then it goes like, I've done a couple in a row that have done like that. I've done a couple in a row that have tanked.
Yeah.
Like it's just all with the same methodology.
Right.
So I don't know what else to listen to other than my own desire to see something.
Right. So in other words, you're not thinking like this isn't going to sell. You're thinking like, I want to follow this through because I love this thing and I'm going to make it.
Yeah. But I think you need to have an understanding of the real world economics of an idea that requires a certain amount of resources to do well.
Right.
And the potential audience for it. Like I do think you don't be stupid about that too often.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've had experience with, I mean, I don't guess you like doing these junkets on some level.
Only when I have certain, you know what I did? I said, here's how I would like to structure these. I'd like them to be long. I'd like the conversations to be long.
Yeah.
Then I can do them.
Right.
That'll
give that.
Well, it's the only way to stay sane.
Right. And it's also the only way to have follow through, but also the downside of that, but even because you're a sophisticated thinker and an intellectual person, but the only downside of the longer form interview is it gives them more things to take out of context. But, you know, that's the dice you're going to roll, right?
Yeah. But, you know.
Yeah.
When speculating about the film industry becomes a third rail, then, you know, then we'll know the pendulum has gone very far in a certain direction because there's a lot more important stuff going on.
It is very hard, especially through that. How do you think your film, how do you think Contagion held up to the real thing?
I think the science is solid. The things we missed were big giant examples of irrational behavior.
Yeah.
You know, we missed a lot of that.
Well, that was a leadership problem.
Yeah. That you would be in a situation in which the administration would be in some sort of disarray and confusion. These were things that, you know, we in trying to keep it fairly intimate that we missed, and we thought the position and the amount of real estate that the Jude Law character occupied in Contagion wouldn't be any larger than that. We never imagined that it would become like half.
Right. Yeah.
We looked at it as like 12%. And when it turned into 50%, we were like, wow, I didn't see that coming.
Right.
But you know, the process for the people that are in the middle of it, you know, we tried to really show it's a very complex thing, and there are very smart people working on it.
Yeah. How'd you handle it? What'd you do over the year you worked?
We were in New York.
Yeah.
The whole time until from the beginning until I left to go to Detroit to shoot No Sudden Move in September. So we were, you know, kind of there for that period, which had a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And dislocation.
Yeah.
But I ended up after we finished No Sudden Move in Los Angeles. So I went from Detroit to Los Angeles just in time for their wave.
Yeah.
It's really been wild to see it evolve like this and to really take on the fact that when we were making Contagion and all the people we were consulting with were saying, you know, this is going to happen.
Right.
Like you just can't quite wrap your mind around it. And then to see it, and in many ways, I mean, the mortality quotient in Contagion was much higher. But in many ways, what was terrifying about this was to talk to some of our consultants and have them go, oh, this actual real world thing is a lot worse than the one we came up with for Contagion.
Really?
So, yeah, they're like this. They're like this thing. They call it nose to toes. They're like, this is bad in terms of just the complexity and full body, you know, activation that it caused.
Yeah.
They were like, this thing is gnarly.
COVID. Yeah.
They're like, our thing was a lot simpler.
It just
like,
killed you quicker.
Yeah.
In most cases.
So this is it's a real testament again to these scientists. There's some technology that exists now that didn't exist then.
Right.
That's why we got to a vaccine so fast.
It's pretty amazing. And it's like, it's interesting. Like you said to me, you know, that there are bigger problems than, you know, studio issues and, you know, movie business issues. But, you know, you seek to, you know, we all did just lock down and everybody watched, you know, more movies and more entertainment than they ever would in their life. They caught up on movies. They saw things they didn't want. They saw things they didn't see before. They used it to ground themselves and keep sane. But I keep asking myself, is that even in this movie that you just made, the movie No Sudden Move, there is an environmental message. There is a message in there. I guess it's not unlike some of the more some of the noirs that deal with nefarious industry and politics. Yeah, but it is a prescient and current realization of you know, industry fucking people, and we're living in the garbage. So I guess as a filmmaker, is there a responsibility as an artist, or do you just go on making movies? Because I don't know what art is going to really change anybody. You know, people are always talking about like, well, art, you know, you got to do your art because that's where change comes from. Like what, a painting? Like what's going to, you know, what do you mean it's going to change anything? Like I got the message from this movie I just watched, which you are not calling a film. And, you know, and a lot of times all you can do is go like, wow, you know, it was fucked up back then. You know, I mean, but Contagion, that was that, you know, that saw into the future. What is the responsibility?
Well, personally, I feel it's to be as accurate as you can.
Generally speaking.
Yeah. Like, you know, and again, we get into a very subjective space of, well, how can, when you talk about lying, you talk about being accurate or what's true.
Yeah.
You know, what is a lie? What's the movie equivalent of a lie? And it's a long list. and there's some very good and certainly some very successful movies on it. And then the question becomes, well, but if the audience understands that, then is it really a lie? Like if they know, yeah, I know what you're doing, just do it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then who am I to say that they can't have that? You know?
Yeah.
But.
Well, you're the guy who makes it.
Yeah. But I'm saying it's really personal.
Yeah.
Like my definition of a movie lie is going to be different from somebody else's.
Like what? So, like what's a movie lie?
Well, the people can change in 2 hours.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah.
I won't go as dark as that people can change.
Right.
But it is this weird sort of relationship that we have with stories in general, but movies, I think, especially because they're so powerful, because it's such a powerful medium when you experience it, you know, in a theater with a lot of people, there's nothing really exactly like it.
And you still enjoy that. You're still making movies with that in mind.
I every filmmaker would like their movie seen on a giant screen. It simply becomes a matter of economics. Like if I'm not making the kinds of movies that draw people to movie screens, then that's not a business, you know.
Right. Well, I guess if we just keep making the TVs bigger. And people have a dedicated room in their house And, you know, they're expecting.
It's getting close.
It is, man.
By the way, speaking of, I don't know why. No, I'm not going to go there.
Why?
I'm going to save that for the end.
That sounded great. But so you, like, you have experience. Okay, so you made a couple movies on iPhones. Was that to prove a point? Or because.
No.
Well, I mean, that's a confrontive way to say it. You did an experiment and you found it successful and you were impressed by the results and it is an option for you. But, you know, this movie you just made, you went and found these lenses that were far from an iPhone. And so do those exist on the same plane to you?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. In all instances, the motivation is the same, which is to, you know, see if there's some, you know, melange of the real world genre, my own preoccupations, format, form of distribution,
right?
You know, so in the case of the Unsane and High Flying Bird, fascinated by this technology and wanted to see if there were things that I could do with this technology that I couldn't do with any other technology, just to see,
yeah,
like what's possible, what's not possible, what's different. And there were, because they were in different formats, it took me two movies to really get a feel for that. And my walk away was, I think both of these are closer to what I wanted than if I'd used quote unquote normal cameras.
Huh.
That I was able to put the lens in places that were specific to these devices,
yeah,
and move the camera in a way that it would be very dangerous to move anything larger.
Right.
And that was contributive to,
right,
like the visual scheme of the film.
Sure. And,
like,
and you didn't have to put,
I felt it was the best version.
And you didn't have to put anyone in danger to get the shots.
No.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And I guess you also learn that in a pinch, if there's economic collapse and the infrastructure doesn't hold, if your phone is still working, you can make a movie.
I'm the cockroach of this industry.
So in your education, like saying that, you know, you're self-taught, I mean, who were the most informative, you know, people in your life as you got opportunities after that first movie? Was it primarily DPs? Who were you, like, you know, where did you pick up the language of film from?
Well, I'd seen a lot of films. I did, when I said saying I'm self-taught or that I didn't go to school for film is a little disingenuous, only because the reality was I was going to a laboratory high school on the LSU campus. And every day after school, I was hanging out with the actual college film students.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So for 4 years, I was in that class every day after school.
Okay. Okay. So you were soaking it in, the real stuff.
Yeah. And I'm so.
Technique and process and everything else.
Yeah. And so then once I graduated high school, the plan seemed very straightforward. Write spec screenplays and make short films. I mean, that's how that's how you get yourself noticed.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can't get anywhere if you don't make stuff. So.
And whose ideas in terms of, like, you know, the films that, you know, drove you or that you were your sort of like Rosetta Stones, what were they?
Well, at that point, it would have been, I mean, Cassavetes, you know, had existed for a long time. So he was kind of an anchor.
Yeah.
But then I remember Claudia Wiles, Girlfriends was a big deal. And then, you know, then you have Jarmusch, you have, yeah, David Lynch, Spike Lee. Like it's, you can feel a hunger in the middle of the decade where the studios just took back complete control, a desire to see something that felt handmade.
Right, right, right. So like, in terms of people you could judge yourself against and in terms of what you thought you wanted to do, those were the guys.
Well, those seemed, what's the right word? They weren't arm's length, but they were not, it wasn't impossible.
Right, it was possible. And it's interesting, out of all those people, you've gone on to make, you know, more, I think, independent films and more studio films than any of them, really.
Well, I mean, well, Spike, you know, Spike's been very active and, yeah. and made movies for everybody.
Yeah.
But, and Jim Jarmusch owns all of his own negatives. So, you know,
yeah,
that's a success that I don't, that I can't claim.
Do you own any negatives?
Yeah, I own seven.
So when you did Oceans, the I mean, that's a franchise, right?
Potentially.
Right. But like, you know, in what we're talking about in terms of the possibility of becoming that, those movies were definitely a brand. You may, your point of view or Soderbergh's signature might not have been a brand, but after you did two of those, were you like, one more, that's it? Maybe, you know what I mean? Like,
I was... Those movies for me,
yeah.
provide an opportunity to play that's unique.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing else that comes my way that really allows for that exact form of being a child for me. Because even something like Logan Lucky is much more controlled
yeah.
visually than one of the Oceans movies.
Right.
So they're in my mind, they're just these sort of, you know, little rainbows.
Well, and, you know, what's amazing is those type of movies with that expansive cast of that kind of talent, they don't really exist like they used to. I mean, it was a fairly common thing to do for big studios to do those massive comedies or even war movies with, you know, every studio player they had. And they were spectacles. So, like, you know, just that thing that you kind of reinvented that or at least engaged that type of movie again for the first time in, you know, decades, probably, really.
Well, it was, you know, I think a testament to the late, great Jerry Weintraub and to the cast that we were able to do three of those in 6 years and keep everybody.
Well, they must have loved it. They must love working with you.
You know, I'm just saying that speaks to their connection, and you know that's a rare thing. You know.
Yes. Yes. And it was sort of like to me, but I romanticize relationships and movie stars. And even though I've talked to so many different people, I still have a certain amount of fandom and awe and assumptions around, you know, people like, you know, working even with Elliot Gould, you know, and Carl Reiner, that, you know, these different decades of show business represented along with this new generation of movie stars. I mean, for you, like, stepping into that, even though you've got to helm the thing and provide a space, is there part of you that's like, holy shit?
Well, I was scared. I mean, I was, yeah, yeah, yeah. I was scared for a lot of reasons. The opportunity that it provided, if it were, you know, well executed, you know, were significant. Like
yeah.
it just means more freedom, the ability to take even bigger chances on things. Like it just, you know, conversely, if it crashes, then it closes off, you know, certain right. opportunities.
Right.
But, you know, these are not problems in any real sense. They're strictly, I'm waiting, you know, in trying to figure out what the next 2 or 3 years of work would look like, you know, how people respond to something is going to have a big effect on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I have something that I feel is ambitious in a certain sort of way, it's going to take, you know, a real leap of faith on the part of the people financing it. You probably don't want to go in with that after the catastrophe.
Right. And none of them were. Those were huge movies.
And then be mad about it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Like, I think you need to be smart about timing. You know, the timing's really important. And I've been the beneficiary of it on many occasions. But it's, you know, that's just showing up and with the right thing at the right time, which just, you can't force them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's just luck, cosmic timing.
But I would argue, you know, being in the right place at the right time, if your interactions with somebody are really, you know, toxic, or if you're just not very good at any sort of connection with people, or you know, working with them in a way that they don't feel diminished or threatened, yeah, or something, like if you can't figure that out, you won't be asked to that place, which will mean being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and that seems to be, like, it seems that, you know, what you're speaking to, there were those people that were like that, and because of that, and because of the intimidation factor and the fear factor, were able to dominate the industry. And now those, you know, that paradigm is shifting, and there's a relief there. Is that what you're addressing?
Well, I hope so. I hope it's going to shift. It should shift. It's.
Do you feel like you've been bullied at different times by production entities, by individuals?
No.
That's good.
No.
But you know the guys.
No, it's more, you know, that I was just never in a situation in which I was dealing with somebody who viewed me in that sort of predatory way, or right, wanted to torture me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or,
right,
you know what I mean? Yeah. That got pleasure out of my displeasure. I just, and that's not saying I never was in a room with somebody who didn't turn out to do that.
Right.
But I never had anybody do that to my face in a room.
Right, right. You use some of these guys, these actors, over and over again. You know, you have relationships with them, you know, like Benicio, Matt Damon, and I think, you know, Cheadle a couple of times too.
Yep. Yeah. Six.
Wow. What do you expect? How does that relationship evolve, and how do you work with actors, generally speaking? Do you expect them to know what to do, just show up and do their job and trust their interpretation of it? Or are you more, is it more collaborative?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm hoping they really bring a lot to the table.
Yeah.
Like I'm really trying to, you know, have the default mode be that they are, you know, completely, you know, leaning forward and sharing anything that they're thinking or feeling, and I'll do the same. And I'm looking for ideas. I want them to be stress testing, you know, not just, and what's great is that working with people, especially Don and Benicio, but not only them, they don't just talk about their role.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about the whole thing.
Yeah.
They talk about scenes that they're not in.
Right.
And because they know, like, it's a whole thing. It's, yeah, not,
right,
it's not any one,
right,
person. So they view it, they have the experience and the intelligence to know you've got to look at the whole thing.
Yeah, and they're so good. Yeah, Don was so good. And Benicio's, you know, he does his thing and he's always great. But, you know, Matt Damon is this, like, yeah, they're all profoundly good actors. You know, like,
yes,
it's sort of astounding, really.
No, and it must be a, I can't imagine what it's like to be good at that.
In what way?
You tell me, Mark. Tell me. What is it like to be a good actor?
I'm trying.
What does it feel like?
I'm trying, Stephen. I'm trying to feel.
Do you remember, like, afterwards, like, the one time I acted on stage in high school, I have no memory of the actual thing. I remember coming out and I remember leaving. I literally don't remember what I did.
Well, I think, like, I, you know, as I try to do more of it and apply myself to the opportunities I'm having and taking more chances with it, I find that there, you know, once you lock into what you're going to do or where you're going to come from, that being, it's an awfully present experience. And when you come out of it, it's like that feeling you had, like, what just happened? And then, like, right, but then the fact is you have to repeat it, which I think is the bigger part of the job. It's like, how do you keep doing that?
Yeah.
And how do you make that continually interesting? And you've worked with guys that somehow have figured that out.
Oh, absolutely.
Because that's the whole job. It's like, hey, that was great. You really nailed it. Now we're going to do it 20 more times. And they do it. I don't know. You know, I'm trying to, you know, I enjoy it, and I want to believe I'm doing okay with it. And sometimes I do, and that's good.
And do you enjoy everything that goes with it? The other cast?
I mean, it's
is the social part of it okay?
Yeah, most of the time, you know, I'm a little like, you know, in order to sort of maintain my thing and not bleed, like, you know, because of my insecurity over my life, I've known, like, you know, don't hang around if you're feeling needy, you know, right. Get off set and ride it out and then, you know, right. Convince yourself that you're okay and get back in the saddle, you know. So,
right.
But outside of that, yeah, I enjoy it. I like standing around eating and talking about things. What were you gonna say that we were pushing to the end?
Your advice about the towel on the hotel room chair is so right and so true and so useful.
Yeah, good.
That I just wanted to say thank you, and I wanted you to know that every time I place a towel on a hotel room chair, yeah, I think about you.
Well, I'm honored and moved, and I'm thrilled that I helped out in some way.
You know, if you can reach one person.
Well, good. Well, I'm glad, Stephen. And yeah, and to you, your movies have been very important to me. Many of them I are unforgettable and have really changed the way I look at film.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yes.
As a movie director.
Yeah. And I appreciate the towel thing as just a guy that spends time in hotel rooms. Take care, man. I really enjoyed the movie.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
No Sudden Move is now streaming on HBO Max, and treat yourself to any number of Steven Soderbergh films. What a great talk. Glad I got to talk to that guy. And I'm glad I helped him out with my important towel advice for motel room desk chairs. Yeah. Yeah, I believe that was in Attempting Normal. Here comes the guitar. Monkey and La Fonda, cat angels everywhere. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here. And when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.